few days, there's some new tragic thing that's happening, and it's hard to predict what's gonna when I start working on a sermon early in the week, what the events are gonna be for the next few days, and then you wonder if you should change the sermon and stuff like that. I thought that it would be helpful for us this morning to just consider the kind of work that God can do in people, and to help our focus be on who the Lord is and the hope that he can offer to people. When you think about conversion stories in the Bible, what book of the Bible do you typically think of? I know for me, I think of the book of Acts. I think of the conversion of Paul. I think of the conversion of the Ethiopian eunuch. I think of the conversion of Cornelius and some of those kind of people. If I was to ask you to think about different conversion stories from the Old Testament, what would be some of the ones that would come to your mind at first? You might think of Naaman. You might think of Rahab. You might think of Ruth. You might think of the Queen of Sheba. There's different examples here and there, but those ones that I just listed out were Gentiles that sort of got brought into the Jewish nation. I want to look at a story of King Manasseh, and the title of this lesson is The Prodigal of the South. I didn't title it that because I'm from the North. This was a king in the Southern Kingdom, and you could say that in this text that we're about to read that he was indeed converted. And I think that word is appropriate to use for this man because it's not going to be till later in his life in verse 13 of this text where he finally comes to know who the Lord is after he had reigned as king for some time. So even though he's an Israelite man reigning in Judah, he experiences a conversion in this story. So let's go ahead and read 2 Chronicles 33. By the way, is my mic too loud? It's not. It's good. All right. I can't. All right, whatever. All right, look at 2 Chronicles 33, 1 through 17. Manasseh was 12 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. For he rebuilt the high places that his father Hezekiah had broke down. And he erected altars to the Baals and made Asheroth and worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. And he built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, "In Jerusalem shall my name be forever." And he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. And he burned his sons as an offering in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and used fortune telling and omens and sorcery, and dealt with mediums and with necromancers. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger. And the carved image of the idol that he made, he set in the house of the Lord, of which God said to David and to Solomon his son, "In this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And I will no more remove the foot of Israel from the land that I appointed for your fathers, if only they will be careful to do all that I commanded them, all the law and the statutes and the rules given through Moses." Manasseh led Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem astray to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord destroyed before the people of Israel. The Lord spoke to Manasseh and to his people, but they paid no attention. Therefore, the Lord brought upon them the commanders of the army of the king of Assyria, who captured Manasseh with hooks and bound him with chains of bronze and brought him to Babylon. And when he was in distress, he entreated the favor of the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. He prayed to him, and God was moved by his entreaty and heard his plea and brought him again to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. Afterward, he built an outer wall for the city of David west of Gihon in the valley for the entrance of the fish gate and carried it around Ophel and raised it to a very great height. He also put commanders of the army in all the fortified cities in Judah, and he took away the foreign gods and the idol from the house of the Lord and all the altars that he had built in the mountain of the house of the Lord and in Jerusalem, and he threw them outside the city. He also restored the altar of the Lord and offered on it sacrifices of peace offering and of thanksgiving, and he commanded Judah to serve the Lord, the God of Israel. Nevertheless, the people still sacrificed at the high places, but only to the Lord their God. when you look at the account that we just read in 2 Chronicles, this is also in 2 Kings chapter 21. And in 2 Kings 21, you don't read about the repentance that Manasseh experienced. It's only in 2 Chronicles that we read this. But I want to say a couple things about Manasseh's lineage. Who is this guy that we're reading about in this story? In the book of 1 Kings, you've got the division of the northern and the southern kingdom with Rehoboam and Jeroboam and the golden calves and all of that sort of thing. All of the kings from the southern kingdom were in the lineage of King David. And you remember that what God told King David was this in 1 Chronicles 17, verses 11 and 12. When your days are fulfilled to walk with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, one of your own sons, and I will establish his kingdom. He will build a house for me, and I will establish his throne forever. Here's these promises that God makes to David, and he's telling David that through your lineage, through your offspring, I'm going to have this everlasting kingdom. And then after those promises are given, then you've got Solomon who reigns on the throne, and he starts out really well and things are going really great, and then his heart turns away from the Lord. And you're wondering, every king after Solomon, is this going to be the guy? Is this going to be the guy? Is this going to be the guy? You notice that in this story, in verse 3, that Manasseh's father was Hezekiah, one of those guys that people may have thought, maybe this is the guy that's going to fulfill the promises that God made to David. Because Hezekiah was a great king who decided to take away all the idol worship that had existed in the nation at that time. And there was a time when the Assyrians came to attack them, and Hezekiah famously took this letter that he got from the Assyrians, and he rolled it out, and then he prayed before the Lord, and in one night God killed 185,000 soldiers of the enemy's army. Can you imagine growing up with a father that demonstrated such great faith? And some scholars, by the way, think that when Manasseh became king at age 12, that it was a 10-year co-regency with his dad. So he perhaps got to reign for 10 years alongside his dad to see how a godly man would reign. And sadly, Hezekiah is nothing like his father. One person said David's blood was in his veins, but David's ways were not in his heart. He was a wild, degenerate shoot of a noble vine. What was so wicked about Manasseh? Well, you see all of these things that he did in verses 1 through 9. But notice, I want to draw your attention to verse 6. Manasseh is sacrificing some of his own sons. And the text implies that it was plural. Well, isn't that kind of frightening? Because remember the promises that were given to David. That it was going to be through your lineage that there was going to be this kingdom that was going to be established forever. And here's some of the royal bloodline being sacrificed by this man. You ever looked at 1st and 2nd Chronicles, or I guess primarily 2nd Chronicles, and you look at all the times where the royal bloodline of David, where they're being threatened and endangered, like Queen Athaliah and Ahaz and some of these other people that are endangering these people. And here's God all throughout these books of the Bible and all throughout the whole Bible. He's always keeping his promises when things look really dark and dreary. You look at 1 and 2 Kings. And the whole theme of 1 and 2 Kings is that whatever God says happens. He keeps his word. And then you look at 1 and 2 Chronicles and you see that with regards to David and the restoration of the nation, that God is keeping his promises no matter how bad things look. Do you suppose people today right now could be thinking about how bad things look and wonder, what is God really like? Is he really a loving, generous God? In fact, I have a quote here from Richard Dawkins, and I don't know if I can pronounce all of these words, but Richard Dawkins said in his book, The God Delusion, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it, a petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, whatever, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully." All right. So that's a quote from Richard Dawkins. And he says that when you read the Old Testament and you see who God is in the Old Testament, that this is just clearly the conclusions that you have to reach about God. And you notice that in this story that we're looking at, there's at least two things that Richard Dawkins says in this quote that this story confronts. One of the things that he says in this quote is that God is an ethnic cleanser. He's a racist. He's genocidal. And one of the places that people will go to show that is the conquest, the book of Joshua. when God told them to wipe out all the people that are living in the land. Did you notice two times in this text? In verse 2 and in verse 9. What's repeated in this text? That Manasseh led the people to do things that were even worse than those whom the Lord drove out before them. Well, why is the text saying this a couple times, that Manasseh led them to be even more wicked than those people? Because this is a hint showing you that the nation is going to be judged just like the people were in the book of Joshua. What was God judging in the Old Testament? He was never judging races or ethnicities. He was judging sin. In fact, Leviticus 18, verses 24 and 25 says, "Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things, for by all these the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean, and the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants." And here's God saying that the same kind of thing is going to happen to you guys. God has always been in the business of judging sin. One of the other things, though, that Richard Dawkins says here is that God is unforgiving. This story is one of the most powerful stories of forgiveness that I can think of in all of the Old Testament, where you've got this wicked, wicked man who finally becomes greatly humbled, and he prays, and the text says that God was moved by his entreaties. Try to imagine what led up to this moment. At age 12, whether he was a co-regent with his dad or not, or co-reigning, you've got this 12-year-old that's sitting on the throne. He's got some degree of authority and responsibility. And for 55 years, this guy reigns the longest in the north or the south. In 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, the king that reigns the longest is also one of the most wicked kings. Can you imagine living in a time for 55 years where nobody's concerned about righteousness, nobody's concerned about justice? And in that lack of concern for those things, what is it that Manasseh did? Well, he undid everything that his father Hezekiah did. He rebuilt the things that Hezekiah had torn down. You think about back when Hezekiah was destroying all of these idol worship centers and everything like that, and whether or not Manasseh was alive to see that or not, certainly he probably would have heard stories about that. It's not uncommon for people to have no respect for God, but to at least have some respect for what mom and dad stood for. And here this man has no respect for God or any reverence for what his mom and dad, or at least his dad, had a history of doing. And so he's undoing all the things of his father. And then he even looks at the temple, and it says two times in this text, the place where God's name was supposed to dwell forever. He goes to the temple, and one day he says, "Hey, how about we set up these things over there?" And everybody's complying with the things that he's instructing them. You notice in verse 7 that it seems like he even created his own idol. That there was this thing that he had designed, it seems, and he had created and everything like this. And he sets it up, and he's surely very proud of all the things that he had thought about with that. He's getting involved in all kinds of occult practices, necromancers, omens. He's trying to, you know, astrology. He's trying to see where the stars are lining up and see what days are the best days out of the year for him and all these kinds of things. One of the things that this text, I don't know if this text is going chronological, where he started out by undoing the things that his dad did and then he got into these other, where it's kind of like showing the progression of it. But in verse 6, when he offered his children in the Valley of Hinnom, most likely that would be to the god Molech. And if you've ever looked up pictures of what Molech looked like, I think there's some debate about this, but I think there's a pretty good idea that Molech was like this bull kind of figure that was hollowed out so that fire could, you could start a fire inside its belly, and fire would come out of its mouth, and it would have its arms outstretched like this. And people would place their children who were alive on it, and the fire would consume the kid. Can you imagine one of the kings of Israel getting to a point where he does that? Perhaps that's part of what 2 Kings 21 means when it says, "Moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another." Can you imagine Manasseh? He's setting up all of these places for idol worship, and people, and there's some of the people that are wondering, "Hey, what about worship to God?" And then he's having people executed left and right, it seems. In all of these things that he's doing, what was God's response initially in this text? It says in this text that God was speaking to Manasseh. He spoke to Manasseh and to the people. Well, he did that through the prophets. That God was raised. Can you imagine being a prophet in this time period where you've got a king who's killing his own children and a king who's killing innocent people? And then God commissions you and he says, I want you to speak to that guy in that society. And then some of those guys bravely, boldly did that. In fact, there's one legend that says that Isaiah the prophet was killed by Manasseh. One of the Jewish legends about this is that Isaiah knew that there was a death sentence against him, and he crawled into a hollow tree, and they saw him do that, and so they cut the tree in half. So when Hebrews chapter 11, verse 37 says they were stoned, they were sawn in two, there's some people that connect that with what happened to Isaiah, possibly. And so it goes without saying that every time that God was sending prophets to this man, he would just, you can see him smugly turning his face, like, I'm not going to listen to what you have to say, get this guy executed. After he refused to listen to God, there was one day when God sent the Assyrians, who at the time their second capital city was Babylon. And they came and they seemed to have besieged them and they took away Manasseh with hooks. Now, if you look up like archaeological discoveries and stuff and you see like paintings or pictures of how the Assyrians would do this, they would take hooks and put them in people's noses or their mouth like a fish. And they would use it to kind of like keep them going on the right direction to tug them 1,000 miles from Jerusalem to Babylon. Can you imagine this king, this pompous, wicked, arrogant king, one day finally gets treated in this way. And it says when he was in this exile that he was in, that he was in distress. What was the distress? Well, the text doesn't explicitly say what the distress was. Maybe he was just starting to think about how he misses home. Maybe he finally realized how wicked he really was. And now he's got the emotional burden of realizing that he killed his own children, that he shed innocent blood in the city, that he encouraged other people to worship idols. And in this distress, the text says that he humbled himself greatly. Can you imagine the sobbing and the crying and the moaning of that prayer? Where this guy finally realizes all of the things that he's done. And unlike Baal or Asheroth or all the other gods that he could have worshipped, the God of heaven was moved. You can't move a God that's made of brick or wood. God was moved, and he allows him to return. Can you imagine the people in Jerusalem when they hear the news that Manasseh's coming back? Maybe some of the people are thinking, oh no, we were trying to restore the worship back to God. This guy's going to destroy it all over again. Why is this guy coming back? And then he comes back, and then it says at that point that that's when Manasseh knew the Lord, when he came back. What was it that he did when he came back? If everybody may have been expecting him to perpetuate the wickedness that they were accustomed to with this man, what he did was the exact opposite. He actually removes all of the false worship centers that he had set up. Can you imagine him going into the temple and dragging these things out and throwing them down into the valley? So upset with the things that he used to do. And after that, he restores the right kind of altar, the right kind of worship. And he's commanding the people, worship God the right way. I wonder if anybody in the society was wondering, what happened to this guy? This must be some kind of ruse. I have good reason to be skeptical of what this guy's saying right now, because we know what he's really like. Whether or not that's what was going on in the people's hearts, we know what was going on in the heart of Manasseh. It was completely genuine. You see in verse 17, this is an interesting verse, that in verse 17, the people kind of got rid of the idols, but they still worshipped at the high places. Now, I used to have the impression that the high places, the only thing that was worshipped at the high places was false gods. A verse like, by the way, when Solomon prayed to God for wisdom in that dream, where was he? He was at a high place. The high places were not exclusively to worship false gods. The high places were also used to worship the true God. But it wasn't the location that he told them to do it at. So you see that in verse 17, that there's some degree of restoration that happens, but it's not full, it's not complete. What is it that we learn from this story with King Manasseh? I think the first thing that we can see in this is the reason for the exile that happens. Now, why do I say the reason for exile? Well, you see what happens with Manasseh personally. That Manasseh in this text is taken away from Jerusalem to Babylon. Which is kind of a picture of what's going to happen to the whole nation. But in the Old Testament, what is the exile foreshadowing? Have you ever noticed in 2 Kings 17 where it talks about how the Assyrians took the kingdom and how they took him away from the presence of the Lord, away from the presence of the Lord? It says it a few times in 2 Kings 17. What the Old Testament is foreshadowing with the exile is being separated from God, I think, forever. I think it's a picture of hell from the Old Testament, that you're away from the presence of the Lord. Now, what happens with the Manasseh is temporary, but this is a picture of what's going to happen to the whole nation. In fact, the reason why the nation's going to be exiled has largely to do with what Manasseh's influence was. 2 Kings 24, verse 3. It says, to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh according to all that he had done. Well, that was three chapters earlier in 2 Kings, what Manasseh did. Or you look at Jeremiah 15, verse 4. And I will make them a horror to all the kingdoms of the earth because of what Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, king of Judah, did in Jerusalem. There was something about Manasseh's influence that got the nation to a critical mass of sin that was not going to be reversible. What is it that the name Manasseh means? What does the name mean? And you might, during this lesson, you may have been thinking, well, I thought there was another Manasseh in the Bible. Well, it's one of the sons of Joseph, actually. After Joseph was sold to Egypt, and then he eventually rose to being the second in command, his first son that he has is Manasseh. Do you remember why he names him Manasseh? In Genesis 41, verse 51, Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. What does the name Manasseh mean? It means forget, forgetfulness. And in the case of Joseph in Genesis 41, it's used in a positive sense that the Lord has made me forget all of the evil things that have happened in my life. And then you've got Manasseh here. And it says a couple times in other places, it was because of what Manasseh did. It was because of what Manasseh did. What's the meaning of the name? It was because of forgetfulness that the people were exiled. It was because of forgetfulness. They forgot the Lord. This time not in a good way, like what happened with Joseph, forgetting the things that happened against him. But this time it was because they had forgot who the Lord was. And in forgetting who the Lord was, you see in this text that they became just like the other nations around them. And they actually became worse. All right, think about your life right now. Are you making decisions with regard to who God is? And with regard to what God would want you to do? Are the things that you're listening to and the things that you're taking in, do they have reference to what God would want you to do in your life? Are the ways that you're trying to process everything that's happening in the country and all of these different sorts of things, are we trying to think, firstly, what would God want me to think about these things? Are the things that we're watching, the things that we're engaging in during the week, is the way that we're living showing that we're remembering who God is? And you see that it was because of forgetfulness that they were taken away from the Lord. What was it that God gave them to help them remember the Lord? There's a few things that you can think of, perhaps, in the Old Testament. Numbers 15, they were supposed to have tassels on their garments, that every time they looked down, they would be able to recognize and remember that we have to do what God says. God gave them the Jewish feasts, that every year they would get together for these seven Jewish feasts. And in so doing, they would remember God's mighty acts from the past. And as they did that, they would be united in those same things. God sent prophets to them. So that they, as they would perhaps listen to the prophets, that they would start to remember what it is that God had asked them to do. What has God given us? God's given us the assembly right now. He's given us the Lord's Supper. He's given us one another. By the way, if you've ever had a friend that was loving enough to say something hard to you, that, hey, I'm concerned about the way that you're living right now or whatever, do we do like what Manasseh did initially? And pay no attention? Do we find reasons to discredit that person and say, well, I actually don't need to listen to that person because blah, 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 they're actually hypocritical for this, that, or the other reason? You see, if this is the kind of heart that we have and we're trying to reject the things that God is trying to give us to help us remember him, just like it was for the nation of Israel, it'll be because of Manasseh, because I forgot that I get exiled away from him forever. What's the reason, though, for the return? So you, in the story, you've got the return of Manasseh, which I think promises, and I think the writer of 2 Chronicles is showing this for the people that had been exiled, that they're going to be able to come back. You've got the exile and the return of Manasseh. What was the reason why Manasseh was able to return from this exile? Well, if you go back earlier in 2 Chronicles 7, this is when Solomon is dedicating the temple. And he says this in verses 13 and 14. When I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, if my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land. All right. Do you see how this passage here, the promises in this passage, after this passage is given in 2 Chronicles 7, you see this idea repeated several times with some of the kings. What's Manasseh's experience? Well, he was in distress. Those hooks in those bronze chains that were around his wrists, do you suppose that there's some kind of application for us with that? Have you ever had a time before where you thought, I don't even know how consciously we think about this, but we start drifting away from God. And we get more interested in other things. We get consumed with things of the world. And then after a little while, we start to experience a little bit more distress. And we've put some hooks in our mouths and our noses. And we've got some chains around us. And now we're addicted to these sins that we started to drift away from God toward. And now we're experiencing this distress because of our idolatry. Could it be the case that God, in his love for Manasseh, allowed him to go through this distress so that it would wake him up? Psalm 119, verse 67, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. Before I was afflicted, I went astray. But the affliction that I went through, the distress that I went through, woke me up so that I would start to do the things that you asked me to do. Now, some people can hit rock bottom, but that in and of itself doesn't do it. There's a second thing that's necessary, and that's humility. There's some people, like perhaps Pharaoh for a time, where he would say, okay, the people can go, but he didn't stay humble in the distress that he was bringing upon his nation. Manasseh greatly humbled himself. Why is it so important to be humble? Humility recognizes that I'm not the one who knows everything. Humility acknowledges that I need God's grace and I need God's patience, and I don't know the answer to everything that I might be asked and stuff like this. Manasseh had humility, but he also prayed. Have you ever had a hard time praying to God before about a sin that you've committed because you're so ashamed of it? And you're just wondering, what is God going to really think about this right now if I pray to him about it? Here's Manasseh, and he's praying to God about all these wicked things that he had done. And all of this, because he was able to return, that was Manasseh's experience. But from God's end of everything, this was all his grace. Can God forgive Manasseh? Do you think perhaps in heaven there will be serial murderers? Jeffrey Dahmer, I think it was in 1992. You can go read the things that he did, terrible things, in Wisconsin. Have you ever heard Christians, by the way, say, well, I don't know how sincere that conversion was. Perhaps maybe like people would have said about Manasseh. Is it possible that he'll be in heaven? Is it possible that former racists will be in heaven? Is it possible that people that lied and had all kinds of sexual immorality, that people like that will be in heaven? Do you suppose that the story of Manasseh ought to encourage us to understand the heart of forgiveness that God has, which seems to be so lacking from all kinds of directions in our society right now? Finally, I want to think about the fruit of returning. When he returned, what did he do? There was a time in Matthew chapter 3 when John the Baptist was preaching, and he told the people to bear fruit in keeping with repentance. So here comes Manasseh, and he's been forgiven, and he's a new man. What's the evidence that he's really been forgiven? What's the evidence that God's grace has actually changed him? Well, there's a couple things. First thing is he restored the temple. Have you ever noticed, by the way, that in the Old Testament, that kings are the ones who seem to exercise authority over the temples? Well, who was it that built the temple? It was Solomon. He was a king. Who were some of the people in Chronicles and Kings who brought idolatry into the temple and then removed the idolatry. Well, you've got Manasseh, you've got Hezekiah, you've got Josiah, you've got different people in 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles that seem to have some kind of authority over the temples. You might think, well, I thought the priests did. Well, the priests worked in the temple, but Kings and Chronicles shows you that the kings had a lot of say over what happened in the temple. By the way, this is just a little quick side point. You remember when Jesus goes into Jerusalem and he cleanses the temple? Much like what Josiah and Hezekiah and even Manasseh is doing here. After Jesus does that, do you remember the question that the people ask him? By what authority do you do these things? What were those Jewish-minded people thinking? Hey, we know these stories from the Old Testament. What you just did in the temple, that's what kings do. By what authority are you cleansing this temple right now? Now, we might not be kings over a nation, but we have jurisdiction over our own body, which the Bible says is the temple of God. 1 Thessalonians 1:9, you turned to God from idols to serve the living and true God. Your body is a temple on whom God wants to put his name forever. Could it be the case that in my heart and in my mind, the way that I'm thinking about things, the things that I'm doing when nobody else is looking, that I've set up all kinds of Asheroth poles and I'm worshiping Molech and I'm following these omens and demons and all these different kinds of things that the demons would want us to do, like 1 Corinthians 10 would talk about. One of the ways that I know that I've really repented and God's grace has really affected me is if I stop just getting angry at everything that I see outside of me. But if some of my anger is directed towards the sin of my own heart, and just like Manasseh, I start dragging that stuff out and throwing it into the valley. Be honest with yourself. The last couple weeks, have those been the kinds of things that you've been angry about? Or has it been what everybody else all around me is doing? Part of true repentance means that I'm looking at my temple. And just like the godly kings in the Old Testament, their anger is directed towards their own sin. I understand that there's reason for righteous anger outside of ourselves, but let's not forget that either. There's another thing that Manasseh did, though. He encouraged others to worship God. Really? This guy that had formerly encouraged everybody to not worship God, to worship all these other things, and then he's telling the people, hey guys, we have to worship God. We've got to get our priorities right. And I wonder if anybody laughed at him. Wondering what kind of moral authority you think you might have to be able to tell people to do these things when you used to do the exact opposite. The truth was that he was telling the people to do the right thing. And whatever source it was coming from, the people had to have the right heart to love truth so much that even somebody that used to live these opposite ways, if they're telling me to do the right thing, I'm going to do the right thing and listen to that. Right now, what is the gospel that you're sharing with people? What is the thing that you're trying to urge people to do? Is it with reference to serving God? Or is it something else? True repentance. I'm restoring the temple because this is what I have jurisdiction over. And I'm encouraging other people to do the same thing to their temple as well. I hope this lesson is encouraging and helpful for us as we think about the grace of God and the mercy that he can have towards us. There's nobody that sinned so great that God couldn't forgive them. But one of the things that helps us draw near to him is understanding how merciful and compassionate he is. We're about to sing the song, Bring Christ Your Broken Life. And this is an opportunity for anybody here this morning that if indeed your life is broken, that this is a chance for you to pray to him and to let your request be known to him. But this is also a time that you can come forward if anybody has any needs, and you can do that while we stand and while we sing.
Remember. troubles you. Oh, bring it all. Bring him the haunting fears, the nameless dread. Thy heart he